once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it's now time for disclosures and disclaimers.
We're just going to jump right into it.
I claim nothing.
We disclaim all. We don't claim that we dis.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, which is neither approved nor disapproved by the SEC, but is regulated by the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, United States, that kind of guy. And the two guys who are on this radio program are also the two principals of the investment advisory firm. But we don't give investment advice on this radio program. We give information and education. And investment advice is only given under situation in circumstances where we know the personal and objectives and all that kind of thing, personal information about a person who we can give advice to, for which, with, and about.
Yes.
And we, let's see, we don't pay for the radio program. And we do advertise on KTEM for the radio program. Yeah, we've disclosed that. Let's see. There's other stuff we have to say, too.
Yes. What we say is not considered advice on the air.
I said that.
Yeah. So I'm saying it again. So you claimed it or disclaimed it, and I'm disclaiming that you disclaimed it.
No, you're claiming that I disclaimed it.
Well, that's your claim.
A double negative is a positive, which means we'd be claiming to give advice, which I don't want to do.
I disclaim the disclaimer.
Yeah. And the information we present on here has been obtained from sources we deem. That's my one chance to use deem. I love it.
All week
long. Deem to be reliable and accurate. However, we make no warranty or guarantee of the accuracy or the reliability or the completeness of the information presented on this radio program.
All good.
Close cover before striking. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't ring true anymore because it's extremely rare to find little matchbooks anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But so very few people understand the close cover before striking.
There aren't that many fax machines around anymore, but we still say just the fax, ma'am.
We do?
Yeah, see how I just did a double pun there?
Do you know where that came from?
I do.
What?
It was a very fast-paced crime...
Dragnet
series where they talked at double speeds so that they could keep more content involved.
Yeah.
And got very good at saying just the facts, man.
Just the facts, man. Just the
which
facts.
I applied. See, to
he always, but he was redundant. He always said just the facts, man. Just the facts.
Right.
He could have just said it once.
When I'm talking to the fax machine, it doesn't care.
It doesn't.
No.
No.
It just gives me the facts.
I think it's amazing we still use fax machines. They're analog.
They are. There are digital fax machines, and that's the majority of fax machines these days are digital.
But the regular fax machine is still analog.
Yes.
But it's the one of the few.
Do you want to disclaim about the fax machine?
What would I disclaim about?
If you send a fax to the studio, we are unsure if it's going to be analog or digital.
If you send a fax to the studio, we're fairly confident we won't receive it.
That's correct.
However, so, if you send a telephone call to 254-773-1400, we probably will receive it. And if you write us an email to either Jeff or Jake, well, Jake for sure, Jeff maybe, at tpwc.com, we'll probably receive that too. Which reminds me, I need to turn my
hotspot
on so that my email will work.
Yes.
So what else is new?
There's a lot new this week. What happened in the markets? Let's start with that, and then we can jump into other cool stuff and uncool stuff and maybe hot stuff.
Okay. The S&P 500 stock index, which is our preferred stock market indicator, went down 1.25% this week in value, and it did so after breaking a record on Wednesday on the upside, and then promptly started down, and it suddenly, someone on Wall Street suddenly said, whoa, what is this coronavirus thing?
What? This is a surprise? What is this?
They suddenly realized that the number of coronavirus cases in China were mushrooming at an alarming rate. They really weren't. It's just the reporting was bobbing up and down, and they changed the reporting again, I think, yesterday. So we don't know what's coming out of there, but what we do recognize what was finally recognized on Wall Street is this might be something threatening us. I mean, Apple has declared that it's going to miss its earnings forecast because of the coronavirus.
Facebook's talking about it. It's hitting the big tech companies that are kind of the ones pulling the market along.
So it's down 1.25% for the week. Now, whether that'll continue into next week all depends on the news and the sentiment and so on. We're going to talk about the coronavirus a bit in this radio program, Lord willing.
It's kind of an important thing happening right now.
So, but it's important also to recognize that the S&P 500 is up a very respectable 3.31% year to date, which would make it up a nice, healthy double digit if it just kept doing that. I don't think it's going to, but we'll see. And it's up almost 20% from last year and has a, from this time last year, and 3-year average return of about 13%. Incidentally, when you see those kinds of numbers, those very high double digit numbers, like 20% in a year and 13% average for 3 years, the last time we saw that double digit numbers of that nature was in the late 1990s, just in going into 2000. So we're continuing to follow a pattern that looks to me amazingly like what we saw in the year 2000. And in the year 2000, we went into the year with everybody saying everything's fine, this could go on forever, no problems whatsoever. And by the end of the year, we didn't know it at the time, we had a recession going and a bear market in full swing. And I frankly wouldn't be surprised to see that again.
We also wouldn't be surprised to see the market get over this and recover, the economy get over this and recover. What we would be surprised is if we go another 3 to 5 years without a recession.
Yeah,
that would be shocking to me.
I frankly am going to be surprised, and admittedly I could be wrong. I've been wrong in the past, but I'll be very surprised if we don't get a market correction.
Yeah.
And possibly a recession this year.
Yeah, I put the recession at 50-50. We've been saying that for the last 2.5 years. 50-50% chance right now this year, 2020.
Late in the year.
2020 is 50-50. Whoa.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
One of the things we had a discussion with the other day with a client was, why do we say it? There's an amazing thing. If you actually go back in the 19th century and you follow through into the 20th century, every 0 year is coincident with a market downturn and a recession. Now, sometimes it starts a year before or 2 years before, like 2009 was actually the bottom in the last major recession. But in 2010, we were still in recession.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going to say 2010, we were kind of in recovery, but it was still recession.
And if you go back and look through all the way back into the 19th century, on the 0 years, we didn't miss a one. So
we didn't miss a one on a zero?
We never missed a single 0 year having a recession or a downturn or a bear market either already started or cranking up in that year. Something like in 2000, it really didn't start until the fourth quarter of 2000.
And before the listeners think that we're superstitious about years that end in the number zero, it just may be that we've got some kind of a 10-year cycle. We've got 10-year cycles going back a very long ways into the past on recessions and so on. So it just happens to fall on a zero.
Particularly in universities where they have tenure.
Yes, 10-year recessions. We're having less 10-years this year, so we're having a 10-year recession.
And why do we do that? Well, that's like asking a lot of other questions. Why is it we have the other cycles? Why is it that we run approximately the same event, approximately one century apart, we get events that are amazingly coincident?
It has to do with lifespan. It has to do with memory. It has to do with what we study.
It has a lot to do with how many fingers we have.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that's a big part of it. But I think we get to a point at the 10-year point, and this is – I wanted to bring this up anyway, so it's a good time for me to do it. 10 years ago, people were struggling with, do you remember this? Houses being underwater. It's like, what is it? Climate change? Whoa, no, stop. Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. You need a mirror to do that. You're about to trim your mustache more than you expect. He's grooming. So, as a thought, we've got to get my tr- track back. Goodness, where was I? You had a big chunk of your mustache. Yeah, you had a big chunk of your mustache in the scissors as you were trying to trim. And I was like, ah! Okay. So, yes, the things that happen in the studio that you guys don't know about out there. Okay, so 10 years ago, a lot of houses were underwater. A lot of, by that, I don't mean climate change. I don't mean flooding. I don't mean real water. I mean that the houses were worth less than what was owed on the house. And this was a big problem. About a third of the houses in the United States were worth less than what was owed on them. A third of the houses with mortgages. That's not all. That's obviously not even a majority. But so we'll go along with this. I am hearing anecdotal stuff. I've probably heard it 15 times in the last 2 months. Houses don't go down in value. I hear that and I go, whoa, you had a house that did. How can you possibly say that? We tend to forget at about the 10-year point, really big events. Smaller events, we forget about 3.5 years or 3 1/3. And there's some really good evidence on emotional memory of 3.3 years is when we hold it. And three of those cycles, we don't remember at all anymore, that deep emotional moment.
And I think the reason is every time you sleep, certain memories are erased.
It could be.
And since everybody sleeps exactly the same number of times, nearly exactly the same number of times in 10 years.
I don't remember that ever happening to me.
Yeah, I got you.
You get what I did there.
And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, gents, enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street about SEC considering implementing speed bumps in certain companies trading. And I know a couple of years ago they had an article about trading companies, you know, putting in fiber optic lines and dedicated microwave radio shot links to reduce the delay in trading. And I don't know, to me it seems like if they implement a speed bump, they're penalizing companies for spending big bucks on technology. I'm just curious what you guys think about that.
Oh, well, they elected, by the way, not to do that.
Put in a speed bump.
Well, let me kind of cover what that means for the audience. A speed bump is, man, this is one of those goofy words. First, I'm going to say there's a problem with the word speed bump. It's really a slow bump. If you're driving along, it doesn't make you go faster. The speed bump does not speed you up. It should be called a slow bump.
It should be called an anti-speed bump.
Right. Secondly, when you're talking about the stock market, I'm positive the people that are listening to this program are aware that there are microsecond trading activities going on.
Actually, it's down to nanoseconds.
It is extremely fast trading. And it's because there's an open market. There are people with orders waiting out there. And when it's recorded, whether it used to be recorded on the minute and then it was recorded on the 5 second interval and then it was recorded on the 1 second interval. And now we're down to tiny fractions of a second. The SEC has the ability to slow down trading for a given brokerage firm, a given customer at a brokerage firm, or anyone else that they believe might be trading too fast and manipulating the market with their trades. That's what the talk is here, is that there's evidence that probably accidentally a series of firms have had similar algorithms and have caused the market to go up rather than reacting to the market. And then all of them have sold, and basically anybody that couldn't trade quickly lost out on it, while these massive firms able to get out there and trade as quickly as they wanted to didn't. So what they were talking about there is kind of an across the board speed bump to take the measurement of when a trade exists and it'd still be fractions of a second. We're not talking about extending this out minutes or anything, or even seconds. It's still a fraction of a second. It's just a larger fraction of a second between trades. And that's what the conversation is. I think it's fascinating that something that technical can be headlined with something that basic attached to it, speed bumps in trading, like it's going to slow somebody down for a week or something.
Well, they actually, at least on several days, and I'm not sure about it overall, I think probably overall, the majority of trading on the New York Stock Exchange on some days is nothing but high-speed arbitrage.
Right, and there's reasons for that. If you are a mutual fund manager or a 401k fund manager, it's
or
not
investing
really
in
fund,
hedges.
Or investing in hedges. If you're the big institution, which is the vast majority of money on Wall Street, because the you and I and everybody listening has some kind of connection to those institutions. They either own the mutual fund or have money in the 401k. These big institutions make these trades all day long, and if you own an individual stock and you're trying to make a quick trade, you are at a disadvantage against these larger traders. And I think that's the thing. Slowing it down a little bit won't hurt anything. I think that's a very clear statement. It won't hurt anything. It won't help anything either. Speeding it up at this point, the advantage to speeding it up just means that we don't have something like packet loss. And if you imagine the old trading pits, those of you that watched the movie Trading Places where Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are involved, that's the options pit, but the stock market didn't look that different. Bunch of people screaming, throwing papers around. At that point, if you had a trade that needed to be done, it needed to be acknowledged by the person, actually a person, accepting the trade, either the buy or the sell. Okay, I will buy that from you, or I will sell it to you if you wish to buy or sell. And that caused log jams. It caused packet collision, if you will. The data was coming together all in one pit, and transactions weren't occurring at the speed that they needed to occur. So computers stepped in. That slowed down this collision of trades. So a computer could take them in and say, this is the order in which they appeared. We're going to do them in that order. If you're a big company making purchases and there's a bunch of people making sales in smaller amounts, they all come in at the right order and you can buy them all at once or whatever. And then that increment of time has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. It hasn't stopped the data collisions anymore. We got that as soon as we went to computers. So really all it is how liquid do you want the markets to be? And putting in speed bumps occasionally for just to regulate the flows, I think is a pretty good method that regulators have to do this.
Well, they decided that's
why they call
not,
them regulators.
I read
to regulate.
The article on when they decided not to do it. And they basically said it's been speeding up ever since what you said when it was manually done with pieces of paper and making telephone calls.
And people running around and high-speed trading had heavy breathing involved.
There's no real advantage. There's no real purpose in saying just because somebody's invested maybe billions of dollars or millions of dollars in high-speed trading capacity that they're somehow cheating because this has been going on
since
the markets have existed.
Right, and there's always been preference on who does a trade. If you're a big firm, you get to the head of the line. That's always been the case.
The key is these high-speed traders provide a tremendous amount of liquidity in the market. We make an assumption that if you own a given stock or if you own a mutual fund and the mutual fund owns stocks and they need to sell the stocks or you need to sell the stocks, that there'll be a buyer. Well, one of the nice things about the high-speed program trading is they constitute buyers. When you go to sell a stock, it tends to force the price down slightly. Or when you go to sell the mutual fund, the basket of stocks that the mutual fund sells to give you money forces the price down slightly. And when that price goes down slightly, that's when the high-speed traders jump in and take advantage of that.
Right.
So it actually increases the liquidity in the market pretty dramatically. Now, which brings me, can I go to another subject?
Well, I wanted to kind of add one piece to this before we move on.
But
I want to
go to a related subject, so go ahead.
Okay. The thing I was going to say is I had just said that big firms go to the front of the line, and people might think of that because I'm using the analogy of a line where it's a fair thing. It's first come, first serve. You show up, you get in line. Let me switch that so that it's easy to understand that this isn't some kind of favoritism. If you show up at an auction to buy meat, for instance, and you have 3 pounds of cutlets to sell, are you going to be the first lot that the auctioneer puts up? If the people in the crowd are the local grocery stores here to buy meat, they need to buy more than 3 pounds of cutlets. So you might be put into a smaller auction environment where people are buying less stuff. Was that fair? Well, it's fair to the people that want to buy 1,000 pounds of cutlets, because they would have to go to you and all of your cousins and uncles and aunts and everybody else that brought in 3 pounds of cutlets. So that's the point here, is that this is a big auction. And the firms that are offering to sell the most or buy the most have the most people going to buy and sell for in the transaction with that firm. And it's not about fairness there. It's about you can buy more at Walmart than at a small mom and pop. Not because the mom and pop's not doing well, but because there's more at Walmart. It doesn't make Walmart better. That's just the way trade works, is that the more you have, the more customers you will have.
And it kind of follows on from that, the point I wanted to make. And that is that we assume in today's environment that if you have an investment and you've bought it from a broker or a financial advisor or whatever, and you own it in your portfolio, that you should be able to sell it immediately if you decide to sell it.
Right.
And that is a very seriously false assumption. If it is not traded on the New York Stock Exchange, if it is not available publicly to be traded and there's a fairly high volume on it, it can be very, very difficult to sell, and sometimes you sell at a dramatically lower price. And what are the types of investments I'm talking about? Primarily, they're called alternative investments. In many cases, alts that you buy that are not part of a mutual fund or something like that.
Or even if they are, if they're part of a mutual fund, but...
Yeah, but you can sell the mutual fund normally
very
quickly. But if you buy alternative investments, and a lot of times brokers or financial advisors will sell you alternative investments because they frankly offer much higher commissions.
Now let's give an example of an alternative investment. A 1,000,000 acres of forest land.
Yeah, but you wouldn't buy 1,000,000 acres. What you buy is an interest in the 1,000,000 acres.
Correct. But if there's nobody willing to buy your interest at that moment, or a limited partnership in an oil company.
Right. Or there's other things besides limited partnerships. There are basically a lot of medical partnerships were being sold in pieces.
Now, here's a really dangerous one that people will be able to wrap their brains around really quick. The production costs of a movie. So ownership and the movie rights.
So a lot of times, anything that's called an alternative investment, in almost every case, is highly illiquid. And the only person who can, it's like a timeshare. How do you sell a timeshare? Well, in most cases, you have to sell it back to the people who you bought it from, and they'll do what's a huge haircut, they call it, on that, which leaves you with not only with no hair on top of your head, but often with no skin.
I represent the hair remark. So just gotta be careful about that.
But alternative investments are typically illiquid, and if you have an emergency or a need to do this, to turn them into money, in many cases they don't. Let me give you another example. Bonds. You have to be, when you buy a bond, like let's just say that you find some municipal bond that you think is particularly attractive,
or your
broker or your financial advisor says this is a really attractive bond, has a high yield, a good rating, it looks really, really good. Ask him how many trades occur a day.
Yeah, quite a lot of those, just you can't sell. You've got to hold them till maturity because there's nobody out there to buy it.
We've had people come in with bonds who have a need to liquidate them because they need the money. And we have looked and looked and looked sometimes for months before we find a buyer, and the people are very, very disappointed when they realize that thinly traded securities like that often trade at half of what you think the value is.
There's another one, another piece in here, and this is kind of like old home month going back prior to computerized trading in the stock market. There were some concepts that are still true, but it was a lot easier to understand back then. And one is the odd lot. What is an odd lot? A lot of stocks That sounds like I meant something else. There's a lot of stocks out there. One lot of stock is measured in 100 shares. And if there's a lot of people, the majority of buyers, and this has been true since the beginning of the stock market, the majority of the buying and selling is institutions. It's not an individual out there buying and selling stocks in huge amounts. Institutions don't like to think of buying, I'm going to buy 6 shares of stock here and 9 shares of stock over there. So there used to be a fee associated with trying to sell your stock if it didn't fill a whole lot. It's the same sort of fee that happens at auctions. It just kind of goes back to that concept. The stock market is a big auction. If you have less than a full lot, it's harder to sell it. The people that buy it are likely to be someone like you rather than the big institution that's saying, you know, I've got 6 shares to sell. The big institution wants to buy 1,000. And usually the people at the institution don't say, I'd like you to go and buy 1,006 shares. They say round numbers. And round numbers are important just based on psychology. There's really not a huge amount of difference between 99, 100, and 101, except 100 has roundness to it. So we think of that as like a milestone. It's no more a milestone than the other numbers around it, but psychologically, it's important. And that's true at big firms as well. So these big trades are going on, and if you go to market with a fractional share, it may take longer for it to be purchased from you if you want to sell it.
And you may wind up with a lower price.
And fractional shares exist now. It used to be they didn't want to break down. I mean, they've existed for a long time in eighths. But you could break that down much, much further. You can go out to 3 decimals of fractional shares these days because it's computerized trading. But it's going to make it harder to sell your stock. It's not visible that it's harder most of the time, but in times of low liquidity, you'll see it pretty clearly. We just don't see that right now.
There's other things in the markets that I think happened during the week that are very important. For one thing, we set a record this week. We set a couple of records this last week.
Mm-hmm.
The S&P 500, despite the fact it was down 1.25 at the end of the week, on Wednesday broke another high record and then promptly fell rather enthusiastically for the next 2 days. Not dramatically, but only fell 2% in 2 days. And it had to do with the economic effect of the coronavirus. The other thing is, and we did break another record, and it's the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond dropped to the lowest yield level in history, yielding 1.889. Now, on February 5th, it yielded 2.14, so it has come down dramatically. And on, by the way, as it started down, the coronavirus announcements obviously accelerated the fall in interest rates, but it was falling before the coronavirus was really identified as a major problem. And that is something we need to watch. This is untrod territory, unbroken ground, uncharted waters here. We've got the lowest 30-year U.S. Treasury bond yield in history out there. We also have something else that I think is significant, but I didn't see it in a single headline or a single news story. I just looked at the data and there it was. The yield curve is inverted again. The 10-year U.S. Treasury, that's our normal benchmark on what the bond market is trying to tell us. It's now yielding 1.473. Now that's down 7% compared to where it was a week ago. The 90-day T-bill is 1.578. Now you say, okay, 1.473, 1.578, big deal. Well, it is still, that makes it an inverted yield curve. The intermediate yields, the 2, the 3, the 5, the 7, are also considerably lower even than the interbank rate. The amazing thing, and if this continues, it's going to be very significant. The 30-year bond is creeping and moving fairly quickly down towards the point where it will be lower than the U.S. than the overnight interbank lending rate. And that would be what's called a severely inverted yield curve. Inverted yield curves, now we can have an inverted yield curve and not have a recession, but it's pretty rare. But that means the bond market, the collective wisdom of the people who buy and sell bonds, who tend to be a bit more savvy and a bit more thoughtful than the people who buy and sell stocks, the collective wisdom of the people who sell buy and sell U.S. Treasuries is that interest rates will be significantly lower in the near future. Near future means within a year. That is something to bear in mind. Significantly lower interest rates suggest a slower economy. In essence, the bond market, whether it is correct or not in forecasting the future, is forecasting an economic downturn later this year and into next year. It did that last summer. It did it into the fall temporarily. Early this year and late last year, it bobbed back up and got out of the inversion, but now it's back in the inversion again. And one of the things that, looking back through history, having an inversion this long, even if it goes in and out of inversion, has inevitably, so far, and since we've been measuring these things, it resulted in a recession within 18 months. And all I got to say is it could be different this time, but when somebody says it's different this time, it generally means that it's not. So I continue to think, Jeff McClure here, continues to think the probabilities of a recession are pretty good sometime this year.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about a recession is you don't know you're in a recession until you've been in one for 6 months.
Yeah, because they measure it. This is one of the loosely held rules, because it can be arbitrarily pushed back an extra couple of quarters. But a general rule of what a recession is two quarters in a row of, this is great, one of my favorite terms in economics, negative growth in the GDP, negative growth. That's shrinkage. So two quarters of shrinkage, and I know all the economists laugh at me for saying shrinkage instead of negative growth.
Well, you could say contraction. They'll buy off on that one.
Well, yeah, but even that's, it's contraction. All right, two quarters of contraction. The economy shrank. It got smaller two quarters in a row. That's a recession. One quarter's not considered a recession. Two quarters in a row, recession.
Which means it has to shrink for 6 months before we realize we're in a recession.
When does the GDP get reported?
After the fact.
Right. So it'll tell you 1 month into the next quarter that the last quarter was a shrink. And then a month into the quarter after the next quarter, they say, hey, you guys were in a recession. Are we still in a recession? Who knows? We'll find out. Next quarter.
Months.
Stay tuned.
But we'll go into this more. We probably need to do some commercials, but we'll go into this some more. There's the general economic forecasters out there are saying the probability of recession, the highest I've seen, that's from Bloomberg, is 26% probability of recession this year.
And by Bloomberg, we don't mean the candidate. We mean the reporting company that he owns.
Others are saying 16%. So something in that vicinity is what the numeric quant economists are saying. Their computers are spitting out 16 to 26% probability of recession this year.
I put it closer to 50-50.
I'd say easy 50-50. As a matter of fact, I'm leaning towards higher, and we'll talk about the reasons that we're seeing indicators that might suggest something is slowing down out there.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember, jobs are the key as to whether we enter a recession. But here's the important thing about that. Jobs are a lagging indicator. Job layoffs occur after the events that cause the layoffs.
Right.
And sometimes they occur several months after the events that cause the layoffs.
To explain that in practical terms, if you're a business owner and your business is booming, that's not usually the time you're laying people off. It's after your business has been booming and then you have a couple of months or 3 or 4 months of not doing as well, and you're going, how long do I do this? We should be able to get back to booming again any moment. If you go 4 months, you say, all right, time to start laying people off. This doesn't make sense. Particularly if you've had a long boom. If you had a shorter boom, you may be really close to laying people off all the time, but the longer the boom, the longer the delay in laying people off.
And we got some things that didn't make headlines that I think are very critical in determining where we're going, but we also have commercials to do.
Yes, we do. We'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. The phone number in here, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth
Coach. We'll be back.
Thank you.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We did it.
Yeah, we did. It's amazing.
I never cease to be amazed that we can say our names. Hey,
we were talking about interest rates. Can I throw out there that interest rates for 30-year mortgages are extremely low right now?
That's not very interesting.
It is very interesting in the negative sense.
Do you have high interest and low interest rates?
I have high interest and low interest rates. Very high interest and low interest rates. Yes.
Hmm.
So Freddie Mac is offering currently for people with credit scores above 740.
And mental disabilities?
And no mental. Well,
no.
What
okay.
do you mean? No.
Well, I just thought they were offering it to you.
That would be me. If I were the anecdote for the whole population, it would only be available for people with mental disabilities. So, but it's not that
okay.
case. So, but they're offering, for instance, a 3.375 30-year mm-hmm. fixed mortgage with pretty low fees or no fees.
Well, based on if this continues, the situation that we're seeing right now continues, I guess you know the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae bonds also dropped pretty dramatically this week.
Mm-hmm.
And that would suggest that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae can go out and borrow money at very, very low interest rates. We may see mortgage rates come down further, which, by the way, won't help the housing market very much because the restriction that's caused existing house sales to fall this last week and this last month is a shortage of houses and high prices on the houses.
So there's a shortage of houses and interest rates are falling.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a shortage of houses, which means the prices on the houses are going up, which makes them very difficult to be affordable. Interest rates this low normally would have resulted in a house buying boom, but it's just not happening.
Yeah, because there's not enough houses to buy.
And the
demand for housing is not as high as it used to be. Barring places like Central Texas, and we're going to say that right away, Central Texas housing, there's a lot of houses that have been built, and we may be at the glut point at this point, that there may be too many houses on the market in Central Texas. This is not what we're seeing in the rest of the country, just as a heads up. So we may see the downward pressure on houses here while there's still upward pressure elsewhere. And that's pretty normal because we have a large portion of our population in this area is transient, and then we have I-35. And when I say transient, I don't mean homeless. That's not what I mean at all. I mean that the military is moving in and out every 3 or 4 years. And that causes the housing market to be in constant refresh mode, where they're selling houses again 3 years after they were purchased. That's not the normal average. That means more houses come on the market here, and more people buy houses for short periods of time and then try to sell them for long periods of time in this area, which has a downward pressure on housing prices in Central Texas. The rest of the country, the demand for housing hasn't been as high, and the supply for houses has been even lower than the demand. So that's just to say that the rest of the market, the rest of the real estate market, has still got some slight upward trends in their prices, even though sales are down. And sales have been down for 3 years now on houses, and that's just something people don't recognize because they still hear it's a housing boom. But sales are down. Prices are still up. It's just we don't have enough houses to go around, and there's not a big rush to build houses, again, barring Central Texas, where that does seem to be a problem.
The South is really not doing too poorly in the housing area. But the further north and the further urban you get,
right,
there's where the problem comes
it's
in.
It's really hard to build on places that already have houses built on them.
Well, they've done a pretty good job in Austin. They just bulldoze the old house and build a new house.
Right,
there.
And there's a limit to that. And that part of the limit that we're seeing is from the cities themselves. The ordinances are being passed about, you know, they take longer to do a bulldozing than they used to. In Austin 6 years ago, it was a pretty simple permitting process to go through and bulldoze a house and make a new one. Well, pretty simple. For Austin. Now, you got to throw that in there. Austin's not pretty simple for permitting. But now it is a gargantuan task to do the same thing just because there's sentiment against it at the moment, which is slowing the supply of houses to the places with the highest growth, which is why we have housing prices still increasing there.
There's some relatively significant items that popped up this week. There's a company called IHS Market, M-A-R-K-I-T, and they are the first people each month to come out with a purchasing manager's index survey. Now, there's several purchasing manager index surveys. Now, a purchasing manager is the person in a company that buys the stuff that enables the company to build stuff or to serve stuff. For example, in a restaurant chain, there are purchasing managers that buy food so there will be enough food there to meet the demand when people come in to eat, and they forecast the demand based on what's going on currently in the restaurant. They don't often publish, as a matter of fact, they don't publish what their current sales are. That's considered proprietary information. But the purchasing managers are asked, are you ordering more stuff or less stuff? And they ask that, a series of different companies ask, organizations ask that. The Conference Board does it, University of Michigan does it, IHS Market does it. IHS Market traditionally goes for the bigger companies, the more international, the multinational companies. And they're always the first one to hit their figures out. And they generally, historically, have been the most optimistic in this expansion over the last 10 years. For the first time since 2013, and it was a short blip in 2013, the IHS Market Composite Output Index, and that includes both services and manufacturing, in February, it fell from 53.3 in January to 49.6 in February. Now, anything below 50 is contraction. The fact that it is gone to 49.6 by itself isn't earth-shaking. What's impressive is that manufacturing improved very slightly, not much, but it's still been down. But the services sector was where the biggest drop was. And services, if you have been following our newsletter or this radio program, the services sector in our economy is what's been holding our economy in growth. Manufacturing has been in a recession for at least 6 months now. But the services sector drives the train. What services? That's everything from plumbing to getting your hair styled to restaurants to anything where you don't actually buy a physical product, but you spend money doing it. And what we've, this is the first time since 2013 that it's gone negative. Now, a single month of 49.6 is not scary, but this is something that bears watching, and it bears watching very carefully, because if the services sector is what's driving our economy and allowing us to stay out of recession, and services in the services sector in our economy starts into contraction, then the recession that I think is probably coming is indeed coming. So this is something needs to be watched very carefully. Now, I don't want to go on too long here. You got something to say about that?
You're in good shape. I'm okay. In agreement so far.
The other side of that is you just can't take, okay, so we got a PMI index that comes out and says, hey, business is contracting as a whole across the United States. All right. That's one indicator, but it's just one indicator, and one indicator by itself is not much. But here's the thing that makes this more significant. I just read this morning, total freight movement in the United States compared with last year, this month last year, is down 9.6%. That's trucks, trains, everything. Trains, we are able to track a little more carefully. It is definitely down.
Yeah.
It's down somewhere, depending on which number and where you look at it. They keep this kind of close hold, and you have to pay a lot of money to get the current information, which I didn't do. But it's down somewhere between 4% and 6.5% from last year. Truck, a lot of anecdotal information suggests that the number of trucks on the highway is declining, mainly because what we're seeing is a couple of the major carriers declaring bankruptcy and other carriers laying off drivers, in which we had a year ago, if you'll recall, we had a shortage of drivers. We just didn't see, there were too few trucks and too few drivers, and now we've gone to the point where we've got a surplus of trucks and drivers.
Right. So, let me throw out some tonnage figures from the American Trucking Association.
Okay.
So for the overall year over year from the month of January in 2019 to the month of January as a comparison in 2020, the tonnage rose 0.8%. Okay. What that means is that we are pulling more than we did in January of last year. But when we look back multiple months, we see a dip in October and November, a big dip, one that we haven't seen for the last decade. We haven't seen dips. And in April and May, we saw a big dip. And then we see this very less than 1% growth year over year from January to January. What that's saying is that the growth is definitely slowed down and we're teetering right on the edge of going the opposite direction at the American Trucking Association. There's other trucking firms, the smaller firms, are reporting massively less tonnage.
And this is not, you might say, okay, well, this is just because of the slowdown in manufacturing, the slowdown of exports, the slowdown of imports. But it's not just that, because a very significant part of truck traffic is food. And the service side of things, probably one of, if not the largest component in the service index, is restaurant people eating out. And what we're seeing is a contraction in that area as well. Now, I haven't seen it personally. Last time I tried to go to a restaurant, we had waiting lines. So that's still a good sign. When you start to see the restaurant attendance start to fall off on what are normally busy nights, that's an indication that people are tightening up their pocketbooks. And of course, we mentioned this last week, but it's something to bear in mind. We have broken 2008's record for the number of dollars borrowed on credit cards. And yeah, the credit card debt has been going up now for a year and a half or 2 years faster than income. It's going up at about 5 or 6%. Incomes are going up at about 3%. Now, let me say something else here that's important. That 3.1% net income growth may be terribly misleading, because I've read some breakdowns and I looked at the Labor Department's breakdown on income growth. That income growth is focused at the upper income levels. If you get down to the middle incomes to lower incomes, it appears that about a year ago, raises disappeared. Now, that's odd considering the labor shortage that we're having. But the bottom line to it is the median or average, both mean is average, but median or average wage growth in the lower income areas has stalled. So we're not seeing, and by the way, this is where the credit card debt is building up. The credit card debt is not building up in the upper income people. They are paying off their credit cards every month like they always do. And it's in the lower income areas that we're seeing the credit card debt rise. And it's also in the lower income areas. So it's rising at 5 or 6% in the lower income areas, while wages are not rising at all in the lower income areas. This is an indication we're at the end of an economic cycle. Now, how long the end lasts, that is the big question. Calling the top of this is nearly impossible, and we'll get in probably next hour, but we'll get into why it looks like we may have a black swan flopping around out there.
Yeah, we've got lots to talk about. The coronavirus and the reaction to the coronavirus is a big event in the economy, and it's going to have some ripple effects that maybe more like tidal waves. Just depends on how big the splash is. And right now, we're not really sure. What we are looking at is the difficulty of restraining the spread, because symptoms are not visible. There are no symptoms showing when contagion starts. That's scary. And it's again, when we're looking at the size of the population, even if we get worst case type scenario that people are looking at, it's less than traffic accidents. It's not good, but it's less than traffic accidents. But our reaction to it has the potential to severely slow the economy. It's happening in China right now. The economy is slowing. They may be going into their first recession they've had in 30 years. And that, I don't know how many underlines I can put on that. They are the second largest economy, And the world is as dependent on them as they are on us, just for different stuff.
It's crucial to understand that any major thing built in the United States, with there may be an exception to this, and I don't know what it is, in any major chain of any kind in the United States, there are critical components that are manufactured somewhere in China. And if you're building a car at a manufacturing facility like General Motors has one up in Arlington, and they have an assembly facility where they assemble cars, and one piece of that car is made in a factory in China.
And I'll give you a hint. More than one piece is.
But even if only one piece is made and they run out of that piece, you could say, well, they'll just contact somebody in the United States to make it. No, because we are at full employment. We have decided to restrict people coming in to work in the United States. We don't have the capacity. If it's a case where if you wanted to make that part in the United States, you'd have to stop making some other part in the United States.
Yeah, and we're about out of time. We've got more next hour on this. If you'd like to contact us off the air for actual investment advice, the phone number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can contact us through there. You can read our newsletter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal.